I'm Jenny Lyon. For those of you that don't know me, Martin and I have worked together on the leadership committee for a few years, and we both have a strong interest in leadership of all aspects. And Martin talked to me about his ideas about talking about thought leadership, and I was very supportive of that. So it's great for me to be here to chair the session and hear what he has to say. If you haven't read the paper, it's well worth a read. There's some really interesting case studies. Just to introduce Martin, he has more than 30 years' experience in the financial services industry. From 1995 to 2005, he was focused on actuarial, financial and general management roles with Mercantile Mutual ING and BT Westpac. He's now enjoying a portfolio of activities, presents training programs, facilitates courses with common themes based on people skills and professionalism. He also acts as a business advisor to business owners who appreciate the need for external accountability, including as an independent director. He's a member of the Australian Institute of Company Directors, Thought Leaders, and the Society for Progress and Wellbeing. Many of you will know Martin. He's contributed to the Institute in a number of different areas, including work on life insurance course, life practice committee in the 90s, the leadership committee, as I mentioned, and for 3 years he wrote the More Than Maths column for the Actuaries magazine. So please make Martin welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Jenny, and thank you very much for choosing to come to this session. Also, thank you to those compliant people who did move forward when Jenny invited you. I think I should start with the catalyst for the paper. I'm not normally a paper kind of writer, I thought this was warranted. And as Jenny said, having worked together on leadership committee, I'm very conscious that there seems to be an almost automatic relationship between leadership and people leadership. And that's not to say people leadership isn't important, but I think thought leadership, especially for this profession, is very underrated. So there were three purposes for the paper. The first purpose was simply to increase the awareness of thought leadership and indeed the importance of thought leadership for actuaries. The second was to provide a little bit of a how-to when it came to thought leadership, and I wanted to illustrate the how-to with some real examples, and we'll talk about the case studies a little later. And the third purpose was to encourage more actuaries to take on the thought leadership activities that would appeal to them, not necessarily those in the case studies. So it's fascinating coming to the summit and listening to the plenary sessions in particular to hear the word influence used so frequently. And there was a great example of thought leadership, was up there in my terminology, right in the very first session, when we heard about the engineer, Ed Williams, and his idea, and how that idea is now revolutionising the way that we have air safety in this country. We've heard the word influence a lot, especially in the public policy session yesterday. So it seems that whilst the term thought leadership, which we'll come to, might look a little bit out there, the more common word influence has been a key theme of the summit, or at least for my biased hearing. So I do want to know who has read the paper. It's not a test on your homework, just in terms of familiarity with some of the ideas. Thank you very much. We're at six. Okay, so that's fine, and I'm hoping that my fourth purpose of this session then is to encourage some people to read the paper, and not necessarily the how-to, because that's just some of my ideas, but I'd really encourage you to read some of the case studies so that you can get a bit of a sense of some of the real stories that actuaries can tell and were kind enough to tell me. So what is this term, thought leadership? Can you find somebody friendly to talk to, perhaps close to you, so say you're getting up and walking? Matthew, you'll need to turn around and find somebody close. But just 2 minutes. Have a conversation. What does the term thought leadership mean to you? And then listen to the other person and their version. 2 minutes, quick chat. What does thought leadership mean? Okay, thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you learned something from your new friend. I mean, it's just by show of hands. By show of hands, a genuinely open question, I'm just curious. Who likes the term thought leader? Thank you. Who doesn't like the term thought leader? Okay, so even almost even balance, you think? I mean, who doesn't care? Good. Okay, good. Okay, and that's all those are most welcome. And there's no doubt that the term thought leader has come into disrepute, and it's acknowledged at the beginning of the paper. And we see a book which I actually like the content of, but I see a book called Sell Your Thoughts, How to Earn $1 Million a Year as a Thought Leader. It's no wonder the term comes into disrepute. And canvassing the concept of thought leadership with some of my esteemed actuarial colleagues at the beginning of this process, a lot of them were a bit concerned about the term. And the message was, just having ideas, even selling them, is not good enough. Right? It's about action, it's about implementation, it's about making a difference. So for today, and indeed the paper, my definition is, a thought leader is someone who can leverage the power of their ideas to influence other people in order to solve a problem. So if you don't like the term thought leader, you have plenty of company. Right? You don't need to use it. So for today, just think about influencing other people to solve a problem using your ideas or ideas you borrow from somewhere else. All right, so here we have the definition. So let's quickly do the how-to. The paper goes through each of these steps in some detail. I'm not going to spend time on all but one of them. But just to give you a flavour, firstly, there's nothing in the paper about understanding problems and proposing solutions. You're really good at being in roles in companies that have got lots of problems. And most of you are pretty good at coming up with ideas. So there's nothing in the paper about how to come up with ideas or how to find problems. You're all very good at that. So we start with identifying the target audience. And when we think about audience, we often start with who are the decision makers. And decision makers are important. But don't forget other stakeholders that might be interested in your solution or the problem. And there may be other interested parties. And depending on the problem and the audience, where you start with those audiences is critical. The next step is about selecting the appropriate communication methods, and we got a great reminder in the plenary session yesterday afternoon on public policy from Andrew Cornell, who sat here talking about the new media and all the different ways of getting a message across. And so for us, we've got so many ways of getting the communication across. Choosing the appropriate method is a challenge. And even think about this summit. We've got lots of people sharing ideas, either on stage at plenary or in the concurrent sessions. And if I think about the example they are showing, people have got some ideas, they bring them along to a concurrent session, how, in terms of communication methods, do they share? We've seen people choosing to write papers. We've seen and heard people choosing to present them. And some of them, they present in different ways with their slides, different ways with their verbal presentation. And I'm sure that's not it. They could, after this summit, take their ideas to YouTube, perhaps an insight session for the Institute. They could take them to their company. They could take them to clients. They could take them elsewhere. And what those take to could be written form, newsletter, articles, short form of the paper in a magazine or a journal. It could be setting up a workshop at a client, running an informal lunch with interested people in their business. So many ways to communicate your idea. So it's important that we think broadly about options. Next step, identifying barriers, absolutely critical. If no one else has solved that problem, it's probably because it is hard to solve. Identifying why it's hard to solve, identifying the barriers, is a really, really important step. And not only, of course, identifying the barriers, but then thinking about how to deal with those barriers. And I'll come back to this point when we talk about the case studies. a little bit about constructing the right message. If we've got our solution, we're pretty clear on the target audiences, how to communicate the barriers, how to overcome them, then what our message is, what our pitch is, becomes really important. And making sure, as per the paper, that we're really understanding the audience, understanding the barriers, understanding what we want to achieve, understanding the what's in it for them, to ensure that our message actually hooks our target audience. Not only hooks, but drives action, agreement, implementation, etc. If we want action, not just selling thoughts. And the last step, a reminder that at all of those steps, you may need some other people to help you. And I'd highlight one of the people who was involved in the paper was very keen for me to emphasise, when you think about leveraging other people, think about people who are not actuaries. I think, for my involvement in the professionalism course, I think that actuaries are very good at the concept of peer review, running ideas past other actuaries, and I'd expect leveraging other people would automatically include some of the people we work with, or we went to university with, or we went to the professionalism course with. But I would think for most problems that we need to solve or want to solve, that we really will need to enlist some broader skills. So when we're leveraging other people, think about the skills, characteristics, attributes we don't have, and think about where we might find those. So it's very important that the leveraging other people is done broadly, not narrowly. And again, the case studies show some great examples of the different sorts of people that might be enlisted. The area I wanted to spend a little bit of time on is what I call applying the intangible factors. Jenny is not only chairing the session, but she was kind enough to play peer review of the paper. And the original diagram had apply the intangible factors at the bottom of the diagram. And Jenny, insightful as always, said, yeah, but those intangible factors, they might be required at every step of the way. So hence I had to change the diagram then. So that's why it looks a bit odd now. But the idea is that these intangible factors can and maybe and should be applied at different steps. So what do we mean by intangible factors? I'm thinking about those sort of qualities, personal characteristics perhaps. Yeah, maybe personal attributes that we need to take the problem from idea to implementation. So I'll give you one example before I let you have a turn. So one example, because the word's already come up at the summit, and that's, we've heard it a few times, the courage word. There might be times in playing thought leader, in solving the problem, where either the barrier's insurmountable or the people are insurmountable, or it just seems hard to shift, or we do feeling like we're under a little bit of pressure, that some courage to continue to make the case, make the difference, becomes necessary. So what's one example of an intangible factor? So I don't want to underestimate them, and I thought it might be interesting to hear from the audience about what might be an intangible factor either you've applied to solve a problem, to influence other people, or you've seen other people do. And Sarah has kindly taken the opportunity of getting a handheld microphone. She's going to be around. So when you put your hand up, or I'll ask you, just if you have an intangible factor you've seen people apply to influence other people when things are getting a little difficult. Now, Sarah also, as you let you know, she agreed to do this on the grounds she didn't have to walk too far. So that's why we wanted people up the front. Right? So if the first people putting their hands up are down the back, I want more people down the back. We don't want to have poor Sarah running up and down the aisle, do we? Okay, so over to you. Over to you. Some intangible factors. I want to capture them and see how they go against my list. Okay, so we'll start at the front, Sarah. Who's that one here? We'll take that one while James is walking up. Okay, give me one.
A language that you can speak to people from other disciplines with.
So, language?
A common language.
Okay. If we're leveraging other people, being able to have some commonality of language to be able to get across and share the ideas. Yeah, great one. Thank you.
Hey, Martin. I think genuine passion. You don't want to come across as just insincere. You really want to have a passion about what you're bringing to the other person.
Genuine passion. Love that, especially the genuine out the front. We're not going to fake this stuff. Who else we got? Thanks, Eric.
Martin, I think displaying empathy, particularly with different areas, and if you can engage outside. You mentioned actuarial and other areas. I think the ability to show empathy and understanding for where they're coming from before you even begin the process is absolutely necessary.
Empathy, one of my favourite words. Your definition, it sounds like you almost answered then. Empathy, Eric, understanding other people and understanding where they're coming from.
Yeah.
Great one. Thank you. Let's have two more. Then I'll run out of room. Who got? Otherwise, Julia, what's one of you? Oh, so we've got a hand. Okay. You've got thinking time now. Okay. Oh, I thought, was it? Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Obstinacy.
Obstinacy. That's a good. It's hard for me to spell that one. Obstinacy. Okay, I think my word was persistence, but obstinacy, stubbornness may be better. Thank you. It'd be more powerful. Thank you. Last one. Julie, were you putting your hand up?
Thanks, Martin. I think listening, I think being aware of people around you and your impact on those, their ideas, and not just having your thought leadership be a one-directional sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. No, great one. This idea of sharing the idea can't just be one way. Right? There's got to be some listening applied to hear the responses, whether they be positive or negative. And the listening is obviously going to help with my favourite word, which Eric was kind enough to put in, empathy. Obstinacy. Let me check that against my list. But thank you very much. So they're, at least we've got the idea of intangible factors. And I'm not saying that all of these are going to be required in all situations. I also know, because these are personal characteristics, some of us are better than others at things like empathy. Some of us are better than others at things like obstinacy, stubbornness. But certainly, I like James's word, passion. And if passion for some activities is maybe a little extreme, at least some motivation, right? So it is helpful. Courage, persistency. I think we've got. I thought was an important characteristic, intangible factors. Optimism. Some view that the problem can be solved, or that the barriers can be overcome, or even more simply, we can be successful. So I'm big on optimism as one that I had in the paper. And the other is, and it's a bit related to motivation, a little bit related to passion, but my other word is belief. And I think the belief might be related to the courage as well, but some belief that what we are doing, what we are embarking upon, is worth doing. So that's I guess it was the feature I want to focus on, because when we think about how to, we think about audience communication, leveraging other people, or dealing with barriers, that sort of stuff looks pretty straightforward. But as Jenny reminded me, in all those steps, some variation on those or the ones in the book may be very important if you wish to be successful. So this brings me to the case studies. And so, as I said, if you want to pick up the paper and my stuff doesn't look very interesting, that's perfectly fine. But flick through to the case studies. So let me say firstly that it was an absolute privilege to either swap emails, accounts, or do interviews with these 11 people. So I think I've broken my own rules about how many words on a slide. So who's at the back? Can you read it from there, Lindsay? Oh, you don't need me to read it. Okay, I'll let you read. Okay, so they're the 11, and as I said, it was a privilege, and I'm very appreciative of the time and effort that each person put into being a case study. And for them, it may have also been a bit awkward when some of them are really big, some of them really small, diversity over time, style, practice area, and I was trying to get them all into about 400 words, all following a similar kind of template. And I was amazed, talking about compliant, or at least understanding, or maybe empathetic, but I was delighted that each of the 11 was almost happy to have their story put into the template. So I also should check, while I'm saying thank you to them, have we got anything here? Mike Sherris was here, but here's an apology for this session. I think David Knox was the same. He was in the previous session, but I think he was a bit concerned what I was going to do to him if he was here. None were going to turn up. Okay. So therefore we can talk about them. As I said, so it was a privilege to be involved, and I highly recommend having a read of the case studies. I'm not going to go through any one particular one. What I'd like to do, though, is highlight some of the themes that emerged. Even though they were very different, there were some things that were common to each. So the first was that word, the belief in the value of their cause. It was fascinating. It was fascinating. They used some different words, but it all came back to this thing about belief. And either it was, maybe not especially strong, but whether it was about the cause being right and just, or whether it was just about appropriate timing, or whether it was about clever and need, they all had this sense of the value of what they were embarking upon. The second, which I was surprised at, I was expecting for a lot of these case studies that the barriers would be technical ones. You know, that there were the issues to overcome were ones that were issues of law, technique, IT, systems. But in every case, whilst there were some of those, in every case, the major barriers were attitudinal, not technical. So understanding where people were coming from, understanding those attitudes, either old-fashioned or vested, but understanding those attitudes became critical to overcoming the barriers. I think I've already mentioned this, but even though they were all different, even some of them were quite, I shouldn't say minor, but they were small projects, they were not lone crusades. Every one of them were impressed upon me, don't make this about me. Please make sure that all the other people that helped me on the journey are mentioned. And so I was very conscious that, a bit like the Public Policy Committee, which is influencing public policy, there is a collective form of thought leadership. But for in the paper and today, I want to focus on the individuals. But even these individuals, clever as they were, motivated as they were, these individuals wanted to highlight the other people that helped them on their way. And without nagging on the subject, looking at the different individuals and how many of them weren't actuaries that joined them in their mission. One of the interesting things about the questionnaire or the interviews, depending on the person, was the kind of reflection at the end. And I asked people, one of them was, what was the key success factor? And what do you think was the one thing that you got right in having that success? And I think almost everybody, the one thing they did really well was how they overcame the barriers. And so I think it's my third and last plug. So have a read of the paper and look for each of the case studies, or the ones you're interested in, at what the barrier was and how they overcame the barrier. The other one, which is, the last time I waved the book, I was expecting that some of the stories, some of the experiences, were about success for their business or trying to have a win which would take them further up the profession or the industry. But it was really interesting that I don't think there was anybody that had any material benefit for them personally, directly arising from their mission, from their success. So there was no $1 million, no material benefit. And yet they all had this sense of satisfaction, and being modest people, they expressed it different ways. But they all looked back with some pride in what had been achieved. And whether that pride being for their industry, or for their profession, or for their company, or for their practice area, this sense of personal satisfaction was very evident. So they weren't the things that I would have predicted ahead of time as far as the common themes. So what I'd turn that around then, especially for people who are in roles where they don't think they've got a lot of power, they don't think there are many people reporting to them, or they're not very high up on the organisational chart, to remind you that there are ways of making a difference, of applying ideas, solving problems, which don't require on personal or formal power or roles or responsibilities. And looking at the themes here, if we've got some belief in our cause, we understand the barriers and how to overcome them, we can involve some other people, formally or informally, we can use those people to overcome those barriers, then I think we can apply our ideas successfully, even if there is no immediate benefit, and we can get some pride out of it. But I think you'll find in almost all the cases that subsequently there was clearly some benefit for those people, as I would expect for any people in the audience who become successful thought leaders. So, Jenny, I think we might have a chat now. What do you think? And I'll have a water.
Thank you. Terrific. So, we're going to have some question and answer now. So I'll encourage you to speak into the microphones and to state your name. Thank you. Since we're recording, please feel free to ask Martin any questions that you'd like.
Hi, can you hear me? I haven't got much voice. thanks for that, Martin. What I find interesting is that the main barrier you identified were attitudinal. And I think that's probably where most actuary-type people fall down, because we're probably good at overcoming technical barriers, but in having the level of empathy necessary to understand the non-logical things that are causing the barrier, you know, that's probably where we're weak. I just wonder if you would like to tease that out a bit more.
Okay. So for people who might not have heard Phil with his sexy new voice, his observation was that, in his experience, yeah, the barriers are largely attitudinal, and it's something that generalisation, rightly or wrongly, that actuaries' reputation would be that we're not great at overcoming those attitudinal barriers, either because we don't spend a lot of time on that rather than the technical, or because we're not really good at, you know, understanding where people are coming from. So then the invitation from Phil kindly was, then, would I like to expand on that? And of course the answer is yes. So I think, well, if you've spent just a little bit of time thinking about where someone is coming from, you understand this attitude that they don't like your solution, then the next step would be, once you've identified, explicitly or implicitly, there's some people who are important to success that are giving you the impression they don't like your solution, they may even give the impression they don't like you, then how can I respond? And the next step has to be, what is it that they're objecting to? And if, as Phil's kind of alluding to, our first thought is, you know, what is it about my solution? What is it about, you know, the way I've pitched it that they're objecting to? I think it's probably the wrong question. I think the question is, you know, what is their interest? What's their position? Why might this not work for them? And I think one of our maybe weakness is the wrong word, but one of our tendencies is not to actually explore that why. And being able to have maybe a little bit of courage, maybe it's a little bit of good listening skills, to be able to just tell me a bit more about that. To actually get some understanding by asking what seems to be the problem. And if we're not quite up for that, or that person is behaving, you know, they're not really explaining their position, then who else might be able to give us some insight into what's motivating them? And the motivation might be a personal one, you know, that whatever your solution might damage their position, or it might be an ideological one. there's lots of reasons for it, but I think it wouldn't be, it'd be dangerous to make an assumption about where that opposition is coming from. So my simple suggestion would be to ask.
Okay, thanks. Another question? Now, there are quite a lot of people here who didn't like the term thought leaders. Anybody like to get up and tell me why?
Yeah.
Sorry. Glasses are glinting here.
Yeah, it wasn't quite my question, but...
No, it's all right. You can
ask another
somebody
one.
Else ask your
yeah,
question,
I don't want that
please.
One. Ask another.
Hayden Burnow, my question was, based on your definition, Martin, of a thought leader, someone who can leverage the power of their ideas to influence others to solve a problem, who, off the top of your head, do you think we could use as an example of the best thought leader in the world, and what could we learn from them?
Okay. That is a great question. Given I've just come to come from the previous concurrent session where Young Go used Martin Luther King as an example, I'll go with him. Right, now, here's someone who had no direct power. And in fact, plenty of opposition. And as I think Simon Sinek's summary is that that's someone who was not, even though he's famous for it, not the best orator in the country, not the only person who was campaigning for equal rights in the USA. So you think about what he did in terms of example, and I think it was, we talk about communication, and maybe we think about being a great orator, but I think the communication was more about the clarity of his belief and ensuring that his belief, his purpose, was really clear, and that is how he leveraged other people. So I think the clue for us in terms of why I think that's a really good example is if we've got a problem we've identified, if we think we've got a solution, then rather than just starting with this, with the solution and the problem, reminding people why this is important to me. And I think in the case studies, I think the person who was most passionate and clear in terms of belief was Peter Vincent, who had a decade-long campaign. And his belief, his strong belief, which he made clear to anybody, is his belief was that the life insurance industry needed transparency. And that was his line. And therefore, a whole lot of people had said, transparency? Yeah, I believe in that too. So he had all these people that were just jumping on his bandwagon through the power of that belief, and then he had subsequent ideas about how that might happen. Is that helpful, Hayden? Thank you for the question.
Can I just add a comment about Peter Vincent? Because I remember as a very young actuarial student hearing him speak at an institute sessional meeting, and we were talking about AIDS, which was a big issue, and everybody was worrying about it. And everybody was getting up and saying, oh, we're going to have to increase premium rates, and we're going to have to get people to declare sexual preference on their application forms, et cetera, et cetera. And Peter Vincent got up to the front and he said, you know, the insurance industry is here to protect people when they're ill or they die or whatever it is. And I just felt, for me, it kind of opened my eyes that somebody would get up there and kind of say, we're not interested in just insuring the, you know, for our company that we're making lots of money, but that actually we're caring about the people and why we're doing it. And I've never forgotten that. He was quite inspirational for me.
Thank you.
James.
Just on that point, Jenny, I was going to also say, I think as actuaries who work for corporations in many instances, and the end outcome is the shareholder profit that's made at the back of that, and so we're a bit distant, if you like, from the customer. And I've heard a few speakers in some of the concurrents talk about when you go and research the customer, you see what the customer impact is. I think that makes the belief and the passion more tangible because you see the end impact it can be making to individuals in community. Martin, what's your observations around that?
Oh, I agree enthusiastically. And look, you know, we don't always have the opportunity to engage with customers, but if you're interested, you might be surprised just by asking politely in your organisation how you might get a bit of a handle on it. Most people running call centres love to show off their call centre. And one of the treats I had as a general manager was once a month visiting the call centre to listen with the person on the call and to hear what the customer had to say, whether it be good, bad, indifferent, was fantastic. And the thing for me was, why did I wait until I was a general manager to do that? Because the call centre people would love to have people come on board. So if, you know, so whilst James rightly said a lot of us are long distance from the customer, whether he is just finding out the market research surveys and what customers have to say, or talking to advisors about what the customer says, or volunteering to have to go and listen for half an hour at the call centre. You might be surprised what you learn, but you might also be surprised how many people would love to have you get a little bit more understanding of customer. Thanks, James.
I thought I'd just respond to the question on thought leadership.
Thank you.
Thanks, Mike.
And I wonder if it's because we tend to think of thought leaders as the Martin Luther Kings of this world, and the individuals who are up there on a pedestal. I personally quite like the term, but I wonder if that's why. But reflecting on that, I just wonder if the observations in your paper and what you've talked about apply much more broadly. For example, I think I see a lot of actuaries and technicians more generally being pretty poor at communicating, and the trap they typically fall into is not reading the audience, not understanding where the audience is coming from, and not talking to them in their terms. So I guess the question is, do you agree with that, and do you think those observations do apply much more broadly in terms of communication?
Okay, well, let me start. I think there's probably three observations. The first observation, why some people don't relate to thought leaders, because they seem to be oratory people. They also don't like them because they see, they're the people that for whom a tough day at work is going to speak at a three-day conference where they get paid $10,000 for 1 hour. You imagine why some, especially people are not that trusted in the audience anyway. So that would be one. The second is, I think, again, generalisation, but, it's clear that not everyone has got oratory skills. And so what I hope is clear in the paper is, think about communication that is appropriate for the audience, but think about communication that is appropriate for you. So if your preferred way of getting your idea across is written, then start with papers, start with articles, start with stuff which is printed and published. Why put yourself on stage if you're not very confident answering questions when your preferred communication method is written? So I'm thinking that, especially, and this, of course, is good, healthy legacy of the actuarial profession, is the art of writing papers and how many it will become part of our library and people can refer to and read and study. Now, some of the greatest actuarial thought leaders were people who put it in writing. So don't feel you need to be on stage necessarily to leverage the power of your ideas. You may, if your preference is written, be able to do it effectively written. Maybe just remember, that might be comfortable, just remember audience as well and what you might need to do, or get someone to help you, right? Supplement the written. Because I think, Mike, was that one, two, observation, and three, how to deal with it? Yeah, thanks.
Hi, Martin, Strang Duncanson. Thank you for the paper. I haven't actually read it, but I will. I wanted to make an extra comment on that term, thought leadership. And then I've also spent a lot of years in consulting firm. Obviously, that term gets used a lot in consulting firm. The other terms that get used are to be famous, or that word there that James has used, passion. Yep. So that seems to gel really well with some professions. And I think in the actuarial profession, we tend to be a lot more humble, so that word is a lot harder. So to your point, I think if we really wanted to become thought leaders, we just need to communicate it differently to make it more achievable for the actuarial profession. The other observation I had with all your case studies, they seem to be only people who've come up with thought ideas, but then who were also able to execute it. I think so. Is that correct? Because I'm thinking, it's like that analogy with the tree that falls in the forest. Yep. And no one's there. Yep. So can you become a thought leader if you are not able, I mean, by your definition, able to execute it?
Okay.
Eventually.
Stay there, Trent, because I want to just understand this able thing. Right. So first observation around humble. Let me assure you that some of the case studies, they needed some persuasion to participate, because they didn't want to be highlighted. After all, it was a team effort. So there was a lot of humility amongst those 11. I'm interested in what you mean by not able. Sure. By definition, they've achieved that, therefore they were able to. What do you mean by people, some examples of people that are not able to?
I don't have examples of people.
Okay. No, not individuals. But what might get in the way of being able?
Oh, I think I was just reflecting because, tonight I'm presenting to the Young Actuaries Program on project management skills, and it's not just about the leadership and the planning and the the collaboration, things like that. In the end, organisations can only succeed if you have people who are able to execute great ideas. So it's great to have great ideas in an organisation, but you can't actually succeed without having people or people with the right skills to execute it. So I just wondered whether that got picked up.
No, that's really helpful. Okay, so it's pretty clear. In fact, it's almost part of my definition of thought leadership that you, in your idea, do not have yourself the power to execute. If you've got the power to execute, just do it. I mean, you wouldn't qualify for the paper. It's who you need to influence, engage with, convince to come on your side, who's got the power of execution. We heard the story yesterday morning, Air Services. Right, the engineer had the idea. He had no power to execute that, but he got the right support to do it. And so where would you start? We think about some of our most junior members. The first job, they're in a team. And someone, because of what their brother told them or what they'd read in a book, has got an idea about a better way of running the team meeting. That's an idea. They don't have the power to execute that. And so what a great way of starting your thought leadership career by taking your idea about how the team meeting might be improved, right, and how that might be sold, depending on the nature of the group or the culture, whether they need to convince their boss first or convince a few of their colleagues to go as a group. Right, would they talk to them, or would they find the article and sort of slip it into the person's desk? Right, there are lots of different ways, but I think just that is a really, really simple example. I've got this idea of running a better team meeting. I don't have the power to execute that. I'm relying on my team manager to do the execution. How might I deliver that outcome? How might I influence them? Lots of possibilities. Go through the six steps. So I think, Frank, you're absolutely right. There's a lot of cases where we don't have power to execute. But if there's, well, I'll give you my messages in a moment. But one of the messages is, just because you don't have the power to execute is not an excuse, right, for not trying to make a difference. Thanks, Shane. Great question.
Thank you. I've got one more question. Great. Thanks, Nikki.
Get in the nick of time. Thanks, Martin. Nikki Appleton from Actuarial Edge. One of the themes that you identified was in your case studies was this attitudinal barrier. It would seem to me that some of the soft skills, listening, engaging, influencing, are quite important skills to overcome attitudinal barriers, and probably some of the other steps, leveraging other people to help you achieve it. They're not skills that we are very ingrained in our education process. So how, as a profession, do we give more emphasis to those encourage our people to develop those skills along the way?
Yeah, Nikki, great question. You want to join the leadership committee?
She's just spoken to me about that.
Oh, great. Excellent. Look, it's a challenge. And as a leadership committee, you know, we're acutely aware of the importance of developing some of those skills, influencing, empathy, listening, all those things. But we are also conscious that increasingly in the 21st century, we've only got 168 hours in every week, and most of members of the profession are working a lot longer hours now than I did when they were their age. So where's that discretionary time to do some CPD? And most employers are expecting that CPD to be technical. What can I see in terms of tangible evidence to do your job? So we've got a real challenge as to how we can find both the space, time, for people to engage in that type of CPD. We'll call them soft skills, even though they're really hard. And also, how can we create an awareness either in the individual that this is important or in their boss that this is valuable? You know, this is one of our challenges. So it's a really good question, my problem is that I don't have a great answer for it, other than if we can continue to have leadership topics at places like this, which we've had a few of them, to ensure there is some CPD on these things, which the National CPD Tour attempts to do, plus things like mentoring, some of the other workshops, some insight session, to try and... But I really, really would like some employers... To remember that these skills are important for everybody, not just the sales guys.
Great.
So if I sound frustrated, of course I am.
I'm going to hand it back to Martin because I know he has a final comment he wants to make. I'd just like to say when you finish reading the case studies and you're thoroughly inspired to read some more about thought leaders, I can highly recommend the book about Alf Pollard. He is a true actuarial and Australian thought leader. When you read the book, I was not aware of that until I read it. It's called The Kid from Norfolk Island. I'm not getting any commission, but it is worth a read.
So thank you very much for those comments and questions, and especially the people who allowed me to get on my soapbox on a couple of points. So I do appreciate all those contributions from the floor. So yeah, I do really want to leave you with a final message. I'm hoping that from today or from the paper or from otherwise, that you understand that some successful thought leadership experience provides some benefit for the individual. And not necessarily in terms of material benefit, but some benefit in terms of profile, career path, prospects, network. So I think that, you know, I'd like to think that you can see some benefit for you as an individual. And if that isn't of any interest to you, I'd also like to think that if we as a profession are better at thought leadership, and public policy is such a great example as a group, but if we've got more actuaries who are seen to be solving problems, making a difference, then I think the profile, reputation, image of the profession will be enhanced. So either way, I hope you believe that you can make a difference.